This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Arkansas Act 60 of 2003 required public school districts with fewer than 350 students to consolidate. The purpose? To provide a constitutionally equitable and adequate education for the state's then 450,000 school children. But education reform ignited a firestorm of opinion, pitching rural communities against the State Department of Education and lawmakers. 7 years later, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich assesses what happened and provides some early results.
I'm standing on the front steps of the old Winslow High School, where September through May, students were treasured and taught by their school teachers. But both the elementary and high school stand vacant now because the district was consolidated back in 2006. The old Winslow school bell is now an artifact. It hangs at Winslow City Hall and Museum, where town historian Barbara Ashbaugh works. She says it was a painful time for the community leading up to consolidation and after, when the children scattered.
Oh, everywhere. We have three area schools that all of them went to. Mountainburg to the south and West Fork, but the school board elected to consolidate with Greenland.
Winslow built its first town school in 1894 with nearly a dozen smaller rural schoolhouses. Those were consolidated in the 50s into the Winslow and West Fork districts.
The towns are no more. I don't feel like Winslow is going to be that way because there are other things here.
Including a very pretty historic town center with lots of festivals and a farmer's market. The census counts 300 residents, but the area has 1,200 families on the mail route, Ashbaugh says. Renee Banks had three kids enrolled at Winslow School when it closed.
We were extremely disappointed in the decision to close the Winslow High School and then subsequently close the Winslow Elementary School. My kids did transfer to West Fork. They did not go to Greenland. They were always and will always be Winslow kids.
And always the Fighting Squirrels, their school team mascot.
Well, we're still squirrels. We'll always be squirrels.
Winslow was among a total of 118 different school districts consolidated or annexed into 54, reducing the number of districts statewide from 308 in 2003 to 240, primarily in the southern half of the state. In consolidated districts, 81 schools have been closed since 2003. Gary Ritter's director for the Office of Education Policy in the University of Arkansas School of Education Reform.
The Lakeview lawsuit, the school funding lawsuit that Arkansas engaged in, like 40 other states have had in the past 30 years, the lawsuit was brought by the Lakeview District in the southern part of Arkansas, and the claim was we are not equally funded. The state funding formula is unfair, and in fact, at the time, it likely was funding a lot of the smaller, lower wealth districts at lower levels than a lot of the other districts were funded.
The end result of the school funding lawsuit was that in 2001, the state Supreme Court found public education in Arkansas unconstitutional because it was not adequately funded nor equitably financed. The court also found disparate teachers' salaries, significant differences in curriculum, crumbling facilities, that's an entire other story, and worst of all, stark differences in per-pupil expenditures. That's when Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee pitched consolidating any district with less than 1,500 students, reducing 300 districts into 100. The Arkansas legislature held a special session to debate this and produced three key pieces of legislation. Professor Gary Ritter.
One is the new funding formula, which did in fact lead to lots of funding equity. And today, our poorer districts actually receive more dollars per child than our wealthier districts. We're one of the few states that are now actually funding poorer kids at higher levels than wealthier kids. So the second piece was accountability, give more tests, pay attention to how well kids do, these sorts of things. And then finally, there was the consolidation piece,
which Gary Ritter says created a very cranky debate. Levina Grandin of Valley Springs, population 130, is Arkansas's most noted critic of consolidation. She emerged after the Valley Springs campus was threatened with closure. Her organization, Save Our Schools, along with rural school advocates across the state, were instrumental in lowering the proposed consolidation threshold from 1,500 to 350 students, saving her 950-student Valley Springs campus from closure.
it's been proven over and over and over again in educational research by independent researchers that small schools can produce a good education, that they can produce it efficiently and effectively, and that they are the best, safest place to put a child.
Today, Lavina Grandin, who's a professional educator, by the way, is Policy and Education Director of the Arkansas Rural Community Alliance. She says consolidation devastated small, rural, white, and especially affected African American districts.
Almost all majority African American small school districts were closed, were consolidated and closed. Not just consolidated, but their campuses were closed. And almost every district, small or rural district especially, that was led by an African-American superintendent was closed. Many, many African-American school board members were dispossessed of their position.
The Rural School and Community Trust, which advocates for community and rural education, studied the initial impact of Arkansas Act 60 consolidation on African-American school leadership and racial composition of school districts in 2005. Their survey of 27 closed districts and 42 receiving districts found the number of elected African-American school board members decreased by 55%, but racial balance among pupils increased. Rural school advocates say small schools provide enhanced academic opportunities just like big schools. Professor Gary Ritter says studies indicate optimal school size to be somewhere between 600 to 900 students, which blends small school social environments with the curricular diversity and fiscal benefits associated with larger schools. He, along with his team at the University of Arkansas Office for Education Policy, have just released a demographic study of Arkansas school consolidation.
The districts that were consolidated were slightly whiter, 76% white to 70% non-white. A lot of this, frankly, is likely due to Little Rock, where there's a large non-white population, and Little Rock was untouched by consolidation, of course, because Little Rock is giant, the biggest district in the state. What is interesting, perhaps, is that the schools then that were closed within these districts were more black than the ones that weren't closed.
But those schools also tended to be low performing, he says.
So, for example, the schools that were closed within consolidated districts had only roughly 40% of their kids at advanced or proficient levels on the literacy and the math benchmarks, as compared to the schools that stayed open, which had roughly 60% of their kids achieving at advanced or proficient.
Professor Ritter is also researching academic achievement in consolidation.
Our best guess right now is, with not great data, but what we have after only a couple years, is there doesn't seem to be much of a difference.
The Arkansas Department of Education says statewide consolidation did contribute to certain efficiencies, creating teacher-mentor programs, increasing professional training and national certification, providing categorical funding for special needs students, more AP or advanced placement courses, and, a big deal, raising teacher salaries. Tom Kimbrell is Commissioner of Education for the state of Arkansas.
From 1999 to 2009, in those 10 years, the average salary for teachers went up from $33,386 to over $47,472.
Dr. Kimbrell was a school superintendent during the height of educational reform, forced to turn away an adjacent smaller district targeted for closure, he said.
In many cases, you had some schools who came together and formed partnerships. It may be two schools together, could have in some situations were three. And so you had amicable agreement, people who said, for the best interest of our kids, let's do this. You had others who were jumping over other districts to join partnerships to try to find ways to keep their schools open. And then you had those who could not find partners, and the Department of Education's responsibility was to place those districts with other districts. And so the state board was saddled with those decisions in many cases. More difficult.
Dr. Kimbrell says consolidation's been a century-long trend. In 1920, the U.S. had 130,000 districts. By 1991, 15,000.
In 1927, Arkansas had 4,734 school districts. Now, they were poorly funded. But from 1927 until 2010, there have been steady consolidation of schools.
Research on Arkansas school consolidation is scant, but one academic study conducted on how Arkansas's massive school reorganization impacted educational choices, learning, and school culture looked at four districts. Those educators and students believed merging increased academic opportunities, provided more specialized classes. They also found more diverse social experiences, extracurricular activities, and major transportation challenges, having in some cases to travel 45 miles one way. But larger classes also meant less individual attention, of course. Researchers were also surprised to find that social conflicts between merged student bodies were minimal. Moved students were forced to compete more to participate in sport, but overall, students easily adapted. Adults and parents, though, had a much more difficult time of it, and consolidation is far from over. Levina Grandin says at a recent community forum, she heard rumor of a next phase.
That we are moving toward countywide schools.
Countywide consolidation seems remote, but education reform is here to stay, says Arkansas Department of Education Commissioner Tom Kimbrell. Dr. Kimball grew up in Coyne in northeast Arkansas. His graduating class totaled 98 students, and that's the next region, Gary Ritter says, based on enrollment projections, currently most at risk for future school consolidation.
If we look at over the next 10 years, at least 21 districts, if their enrollment moves the way it's moved the past few years, are going to be at risk of consolidation. It means they're going to be approaching or get under that 350 number.
Those campuses tend to be poor and African American. But Professor Gary Ritter says geographic issues may start to come into play the next round. For example, he says if Deer, Mountain Judy schools in the Ozarks merge with Jasper, their joint district will cover 400 square miles of mountains. That's one long bus ride. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And if you'd like to see a school portrait taken on the very last day ever of school at Winslow Public Schools, home of the Winslow Squirrels, you can visit our webpage, OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Election Day is 4 weeks from today. Early voting in the 2010 general election begins 2 weeks from yesterday. A new poll from TalkBusiness.net and Hendricks College indicates Governor Mike Beebe continues to lead his GOP challenger, Jim Key. The poll, conducted last week, shows the incumbent with a 13-point lead. The poll of 588 likely voters shows Governor Beebe with 48.5% support compared to Jim Keats' 35%. Green Party nominee Jim Lindell has about 2% in the poll, and 15% of voters surveyed say they are still undecided. The poll's margin of error is plus or minus 4%. That same poll also asked the likely voters if a Governor Beebe endorsement of another candidate seeking state office would influence their decision to support that candidate. 43% polled said very likely. Another 25% said somewhat likely. So does that mean the governor has coattails that could extend down ballot? That's one of the questions Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net asked Steve Bronner, an independent journalist in Arkansas and the author of a weekly opinion column for Stevens Media.
Let's start first with our latest Talk Business poll. BB 48.5%, Keith 35%. What do you see in these numbers that's good for Mike Beebe?
Well, the obvious thing that's good about it is that he's ahead by about 13 points. That's obviously, you'd rather be ahead than behind. And what those numbers don't reflect is that he has just a huge fundraising advantage. And we're going to see that fundraising advantage in the next month. Is I'm sure the airwaves are just going to be filled with all BB all the time. Keat, on the other hand, has almost no money. And basically, he's running a campaign by press conference right now. That is probably not going to be enough. So these are good numbers for BB in that way.
Well, obviously, BB's not over 50%. That would be a positive for the Keat camp. What else do you see as positives and negatives in these numbers for Jim Keat?
That would be the thing he takes away from it. Typically, that 50% plateau is what you're looking for. And if an incumbent is below 50%, they've got some problems. So that's one thing that Keat can take from this is that Mike Beebe, despite having the powers of incumbency, 4 years of publicity, and a long political career, still has not reached that 50%. So at least Keat can take that away from that.
We also explored those potential BB coattails, which seem like a pretty big positive. We're seeing BB help fundraise and support some other candidates. I guess my question to you is, do you think this is going to translate to voters?
I don't see how it translates to the Washington congressional races, the Senate campaign and the House races. I can see it coming down a little bit front in the state constitutional officer races, particularly lieutenant governor's race. There'll be no BB Broadway tickets, that being Shane Broadway, who's running for the lieutenant governor's race on the Democratic side. But you will see the two are appearing together now, and you'll see, I think that you can see that kind of translate, because they both can make the argument that this is a team, that if you're going to elect one, it sure would help Governor Beebe if his lieutenant governor was somebody he could work with. The past 4 years, Governor Beebe has had a lieutenant governor that he really wasn't very close to. And then there's not a cabinet-type relationship between the lieutenant governor and the governor. But it's nice when the governor knows the lieutenant governor is somebody he can work with, that he can leave the state without worrying about the lieutenant governor doing something he doesn't like, or that he can call upon the lieutenant governor if there's some funeral that he doesn't want to go to or doesn't have the time to go to. It's nice to have a lieutenant governor that he can work with. So I think you'll see BB and Broadway working together a little bit. As far as the other down-ballot races, I don't know how far BB's coattails will reach.
Yeah, two races that many folks don't concentrate on, and you mentioned one lieutenant governor's race there. Lieutenant governor and secretary of state, they have definitely had their fair share of fireworks and headlines this week. Kind of give me a capsule summary of what you see at work in those two races.
Well, once you get past the big ticket races, those down ballot races for lieutenant governor, secretary of state, the other races and the other state constitutional officer races, it's harder and harder to get attention, harder and harder to get voters to really pay attention to what you're trying to do and to get your message out. You've seen in the Republican, Mark Darr has run somewhat of a negative ad about Shane Broadway, the Democrat, and the lieutenant governor's race. In the secretary of state's race, that one's gotten a little bit nasty. You're seeing the Democrat, Pat O'Brien, making publicity about the Republican Mark Martin's legislative per diem expenses. You're seeing Mark Martin questioning Pat O'Brien's fairness because he ran the 2008 Obama campaign in Pulaski County. They have been going after each other a little bit, so that one's a little bit more interesting race. Whether that translates into anybody paying attention is another question.
Steve, you and I have had some conversations about the state of politics in Arkansas and nationally, especially as this campaign ad season swings into a higher gear. In 30-second soundbites, we're supposed to learn everything we need to know about a politician's positions and how he or she's going to solve our state's and nation's problems, right?
Well, no, but actually I think you can say a lot in 30 seconds, and I wish they would. You know, the Gettysburg Address was only 10 sentences long, and you could put the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the New Testament in your back pocket. So it is possible to say a lot in a short amount of words. And I think that in 30 seconds, actually, you could get a better sense of where these candidates stand on issues. The problem is that for my entire lifetime, no one's tried it. And our political ads have been basically what we've all seen, either kind of overly dramatic biographical ads, or they've been attack ads against the other opponent. Is this a way to run a democracy? I don't know. But I don't think it hasn't been illuminating, and it won't be illuminating as long as the voters allow it to continue.
So, what do you think is a solution to this soundbite world that we live in?
I think it's up to the voters. It's up to the voters to say that this is not enough. We have the opportunity to research the candidates. We have the opportunity to question the candidates. And we have the opportunity to make decisions on who we're going to vote for based on the kind of campaign they run. And I think it's time for some of us to say, you know what, I might agree with this particular candidate more, but he lied to me. I watched him lie to me. And he manipulated me. And he assassinated somebody's character. And he insulted my intelligence over and over again. So even though I might agree with what he says more than the other candidate, I'm going to reward the other candidate with my votes. And if they both do it, I'm not going to vote for either one of them. But it's up to the voters to make the decision on who they're going to vote for. And I think that the kind of campaign the candidate runs is a direct reflection of their character. And if we choose to reward those kind of people with elected office, then we're going to get the democracy we deserve.
There's going to be three constitutional amendment proposals on the ballot this year. One of those is going to preserve an Arkansan's right to hunt, fish, and trap. You've written recently on the subject that it might not be a good idea. Why don't you explain?
Well, to me, this is a solution in search of a problem. We have the right to hunt, fish, and trap, but there are limits to that right, and it's limits that we've agreed to democratically through our legislative process, through the Game and Fish Commission, Ducks Unlimited, all kinds of groups that work together, and it all works pretty well. If you put something in the Constitution, then you take it away from all this group of common sense Arkansans who've come to pretty good conclusions on all this, and you put it in the hands of lawyers and judges. If it's in the Constitution, somebody will sue. And because they can sue, then instead of this broad group of people making a decision on what we're going, how we're going to handle this right, you're going to have it all be in the hands of a judge. And how that judge is going to rule is really up to the judge. And at least until the appeals process continues, what that judge says is how it's going to be. I think we're a lot better off just letting things stay as they are. The status quo is pretty good and it enjoys broad support. And I don't think this is just unnecessary.
All right, Steve, give me a political prediction, your best shot at something you think is going to happen in the near term, this election season.
I think during the election, I think that the Democrats will narrowly hold on to at least the Senate nationally. And I think that President Obama will wish they hadn't.
Steve Bronner is an independent journalist in Arkansas and the author of a weekly opinion column for Stevens Media. He talked to Roby Brock, the publisher of the magazine Talk Business Quarterly and the publisher of the website TalkBusiness.net. Support for Roby's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. Thursday, as many as 3,000 visitors will take in spiders, praying mantises, and cockroaches at the 11th Insect Festival of Arkansas at the Pauline Whitaker Animal Center in Fayetteville. The Insect Festival requires as many as 70 volunteers for each edition and brings together entomologists from the University of Arkansas and from around the state. Don Steinkraus, a professor in the Department of Entomology at the U of A, has been with the festival since its first year, 1993. He says the first two festivals were held in Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main, but popularity mandated a change.
And they got outgrown very rapidly. We had no idea it'd be so successful. And the very first one, hundreds of people showed up at Giffel's. And it just was the traffic. You know how parking is on campus. To have lots of cars trying to park there and get in was very difficult. So then we moved it to the Union. Then we moved it to Barnhill. And we finally have settled on having it here in the Pauline Whitaker Arena.
Some of the top attractions from years past will be there again Thursday. Exotic insects from outside the region and many of the insects from the Ozarks will also be on display. While generally held for children, the Insect Festival rarely disappoints anybody of any age. Madagascar hissing cockroaches, black widows, and brown recluse spiders can get gas from just about everybody. And the few dangerous species are kept safely away from the curious.
We have an educational aspect of it where people will see these things alive and dead and be able to look at them and ask questions and learn about the insect world. So that's educational, but we also have a fun element where we have crafts and games for kids of all ages to participate. Like our cockroach races are particularly popular, where we have these large cockroaches that race down a racetrack and the kids can choose their favorites.
Don Steinkraus says for this 11th edition on Thursday, there was no problem filling the venue with plenty of things to see and do.
There will be a cotton patch where there's like ripe cotton and the kids will learn how cotton is ginned and the insect pests of cotton. And there will be the museum collection where we have all our exotic insects and people can learn a lot from experts about insects they might see or insects in the tropics. We'll have a honeybee apiculture display. We'll have a bee waggle dance where people can see a person doing the waggle dance. A special new thing this year is the insect theater.
Let's hear a big cheer for the maggot.
That's right. He said insect theater. Four times Thursday, entomology students in costume, spider, mosquito, stink bug, will help audiences understand the difference between complete and incomplete metamorphosis, understand the insect food chain, and identify parts of the insect body. A rehearsal last week indicated it's a high-energy affair, and it's musical insect theater. Entomology students Bevan Williams and Daniel Keeler provide voice and fiddle to accompany Don Steinkraus on guitar. The insect cast, in vivid, oversized costumes, wants to explain more about the animals they portray. Brian Petty is a wasp.
They're normally not that aggressive. Most bees and wasps aren't, unless you really make them angry. So they won't come hunt you down.
So you're basically a nice guy.
Yep. All right. Just misunderstood.
I'm Kelly Carruthers.
Ooh, you're a mantis?
Yeah, I'm a fierce praying mantis.
Okay, now I am fascinated by praying mantis.
Oh, so am I.
Okay. What fascinates you about them?
They're just really interesting. And I mean, they're predators, but they're not kind of the normal predators. And they're very camouflaged, so you can't really see them. And they don't move a whole lot. But, you know, when they do move, they strike and they attack, and it's really cool. And it's just, but they're really gentle. And, you know, if you pick them up, they can't really hurt you too bad. I've been bitten by one, but, like, I mean, it's not, they just, the little mouth parts pinch. It's not even a big deal.
The 11th Insect Festival of Arkansas is Thursday at the Pauline Whitaker Animal Science Center on Garland Avenue in Fayetteville. The event is free and open to everybody from 9 until 4. For more information, entomology.uark.edu. Are you a method actor? Do you have to think like a mosquito for a few hours before?
Yes, I do. I have to get in the zone. I twitch a little bit when I get caught in the web, so I got to be at one with the mosquito.
To hear more comments from the cast of Insect Theater, you can go online to OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
Chewie, you hurt me like a bee, a bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. I gave you love as sweet as honey, my life, my soul, and all my money.
The legendary and vastly underrated Laverne Baker with the song Bumblebee. Time to mark your calendars for some events. The Fayetteville Public Education Foundation and the Fayetteville High School Student Council will host the 14th annual Fayetteville Schools Hall of Honor Thursday night at the Town Center in Fayetteville. It will include dinner by Chef Miles James with wine and hors d'oeuvres at 5:30, dinner at 6:30. For more information, 527-3656. A guide to mushrooms in Arkansas is scheduled to take place at Devil's Den State Park on October 8th. That's Friday from 9 until 4. Jay Justice, co-founder of the Arkansas Mycology Society, will discuss the array of edible and poisonous mushrooms found across the natural state. For more information, 761-3325. The 25th annual Fort Smith Knights of Columbus Oktoberfest will be Friday from 5 until 11 p.m. and Saturday from 2 until 11 at Columbus Acres in Fort Smith. Music, German food, kids' games, and more. For more information, 649-7144. And Main Street Ozark and the Ozark American Legion will present Old Fashioned Pie Supper. That's Saturday night at 6 o'clock in the Foothills Little Theater at 12th and School Streets in downtown Ozark. All proceeds will go to the building fund. Entertainment will be provided by the River Blenders Barbershop Quartet. For more information, mainstreetozark.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
Like a bee, a bumblebee, an evil bumblebee.
It is Tuesday, October 5th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And if you happen to be in the River Valley, go to this for me. There's a book sale from 7:30 to 5 today through Thursday at the Smith Pendergraft Campus Center at the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith. Book sale. You should go. There's also another event at the Shiloh Museum.
They're busy this week.
Ozark, A Celebration in Song. It's a screening of the new documentary film collaboration between Still on the Hill and the Jones TV Network. And it starts at 7 o'clock, and it is my favorite word.
Free. And in case you're wondering, it's songs that Still on the Hill wrote about real people, real places, real events, and the documentary shows those places, people, and
great
events.
Great fun.
And that's at Shiloh Museum, free today.
At 7.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
And when he died,
all he left us was alone.
Richard Street, R&B singer and member of The Temptations, was born on this date in 1942. The American vocal group was noted for their smooth harmonies and intricate choreography. Recording primarily for Motown Records, they were among the most popular performers of soul music in the 1960s and 70s. The Temptations were formed in 1961 from the coupling of two vocal groups based in Detroit, The Primes, originally from Alabama, and The Distance. That same year, they signed with Motown. After a slow start, the Temptations turned out a string of romantic hits, beginning with The Way You Do the Things You Do, My Girl, Get Ready, and Beauty Is Only Skin Deep. Paragons of sleek fashion and practitioners of athletic choreography, the Temps epitomized sophisticated cool. In the late 1960s, they shifted to a more funk-oriented sound and to more socially conscious material when Norman Whitfield became the group's producer and principal songwriter. Influenced by psychedelic rock, the Temptations produced hits such as Cloud Nine, Runaway Child Running Wild, Psychedelic Shack, Ball of Confusion, That's What the World Is Today, and the Grammy Award-winning Papa Was a Rolling Stone. In 1968 to 1969, they were paired with Diana Ross and the Supremes for two television specials and recordings that included I'm Gonna Make You Love Me and I'll Try Something New. From the mid-1970s, the Temptations changed personnel frequently and produced occasional hits, but they never regained the form that earned them induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1989. Rockabilly musician Billy Lee Riley was born in Pocahontas on this date in 1933. Riley's career began in the Arkansas Delta and peaked in the 1950s after he signed a record deal with Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee. He recorded many songs during his career, alternating between the rockabilly style that made him famous and the blues music that he loved. Also on this date in 1947, in the first televised White House address, President Truman asked Americans to refrain from eating meat on Tuesdays and poultry on Thursdays to help stockpile grain for starving people in Europe. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas's state revenues fell short of forecast levels last month, but the September numbers were 6.9% above 2009 levels. State Finance Director Richard Weiss says overall, that's good news.
Against forecast, we're a little bit below, but I think the real message is here for the fifth straight month, we're above last year's collections, which is 5 months of growth that we've had, which is fairly unprecedented.
The question is Arkansas in the midst of an economic recovery?
We're looking at very uneven recovery. I certainly think all signs to me indicate we're in recovery. We're going to have some months that are up and some months that are down, but overall the trend is positive.
Richard Weiss says sluggish individual tax collections dropped revenues below forecast. He says people who pay income taxes on a quarterly basis have only had to match 2009 levels, allowing them to hold on to additional income until they have to settle up with the state in April. Good economic news across the state. Production got underway yesterday at a new wind energy plant in Jonesboro. The facility is fueling the local job market with 42 employees hired so far. Jonesboro Mayor Mark Perrin credits the local workforce and that region's education system for bringing the German-based company Nordex to his city.
We have an excellent labor force in Jonesboro that they were looking for. The second thing is Arkansas State University has the workforce training center here, which they had already gone over to Germany and looked at the operation and got all of the instructors and stuff ready here in Jonesboro. That was a great incentive.
Mayor Perrin says the plant is expected to create about 500 jobs in the next 2 years. Nordex officials believe the U.S. wind market will be the biggest in the world. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. We are a ranking-obsessed culture. We rank our college sports teams. We buy books that rank our colleges based on academics, social life, and affordability. We know every week the movie that topped the box office the previous weekend and the TV show that claimed the most viewers. And we love to rank history, too. The best this, the most monumental that. And there have been many rankings devoted to the best and worst presidents. If you start ranking historical figures, you'll likely gain the attention of our history doctor, Bill Smith. Bill has those presidential rankings on his mind. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be back.
This just in, Barack Obama is the worst president ever?
Or the best president ever, depending on who you ask. Again, no shock there. It's all about opinion. But for a man who won the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year in office, scoring just 15th, on the most recent scholarly survey, is a bit of a letdown. But that's okay, because we seem to have a new partisan media poll where he's dropping like a stone. This on the heels of several recent polls to remind us the last sitting president was one of the worst of all time.
Siena University has had a recent poll, have they not?
Well, full disclosure here, I've twice had the chance to present scholarly papers at Siena College, and they have become the most regular pollster of historians for these presidential rankings. And I know the co-directors, Thomas Kelly and Douglas Lonstrom. The most recent survey in 2010 gives us a bit of pause because you wonder if it's being done for attention for the poll. Now, that might seem quite unfair, but how does one judge a sitting president without a certain amount of bias, pro or con, only a year and a half into his first term?
Siena College has done these polls before on a somewhat regular basis.
Yes, yes. Kelly and Lonstrom have taken over from Arthur Schlesinger, the historian and former JFK advisor in the history world. Schlesinger made the first ever of these rankings of the opinion of historians as to who was the best or worst president back in 1948. He then repeated it in 62 and 96. Siena has done polls now in 82, 90, 94, 2002, and again, most recently, here in 2010.
You know, in the sports world, you have this all the time. Who was better, Barry Bonds or Babe Ruth, Willie Mays or Jimmy Fox? So what happens with these presidential polls?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in scoring against the times in which a president served, looking at what we would call in the historical profession the zeitgeist or the time spirit. And it'll be no surprise to anyone that follows this segment that we're no big fans of presentism here, which is taking our times and viewing the efforts of a president against our current standards.
There is a level of difficulty that helps one, I think, sometimes get ranked high or low. Abraham Lincoln generally is at the very top of these polls. He had a divided nation and a civil war to deal with, which helped him rise to the top because he handled it the way he did.
Well, Bill Clinton might be one of the best examples of that. He is one of our more significant recent presidents, and if he had been called to serve under more challenging circumstances, he might be a pretty regular in the top 10. But a pretty good economy and an opposition Congress added up to reasonably easy two terms in office, historically speaking. He did what the people wanted, maintained the status quo. How different is he from, say, Calvin Coolidge, who had similar circumstances in the early 20s? But in a lot of polls, the score for each of these men is very wide apart, and they tend to be even more so in the media-driven polls.
So while it might not be something you want for the graying of your hair, in these historical polls, the old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, comes to mind.
Exactly. It's no surprise that our crisis presidents, Washington, Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, are highly ranked, as well as our more activist presidents like Thomas Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay, you're going at least half a century back with all of those. What about our most two recent, Barack Obama and the second George Bush?
Anyone who tells you that it isn't about personal politics or personal point of view of how to look at these recent presidents in polls is, well, a presentist liar. They remain fashionable, not really historical, for at least a couple of decades before they can move back and be judged against those standards of time. You know, will Barack Obama become the Martin Van Buren of the 21st century, well regarded by scholars who were surveyed by the likes of Arthur Schlesinger in 48 and 62, but now he's pretty routinely panned as a bottom-tier president, particularly in the more media-oriented surveys? Or will he become a William McKinley, a Republican who you can make a pretty significant argument for launching one of the more significant wars of choice, the Spanish-American War, and just sort of sits in the middle of the pack? Will George Bush become the Dwight Eisenhower, as many of his protagonists would like to say? Eisenhower, panned as 22nd in the early surveys, a third-tier president in the Schlesinger poll, but since has become a pretty regular top 10, top 15 pick. Time, and not the magazine, is the best sorting mechanism when we look back at these presidents.
Can you find some more recent examples of that?
Consider that three presidents of the 1960s era, a decade that is just starting to fade from the direct collective memory, and where JFK, LBJ, and Nixon stand in these rankings. All three of them widely fluctuate, extremely so for John F. Kennedy.
You alerted me some time ago about this sort of combination poll that takes all the polls and puts them together, sort of the BCS of presidential polls.
Yeah, this aggregation chart that I found on Wikipedia. And you know, the thing about Wikipedia is occasionally you're going to find really good mashups. And this is one where you can see the colors of all the polls over the years. And it's a real great comparison that reminds me of when you'd see the computer rankings for the bowl championship series and the various voters and how different presidents will flux up and down. It tends to show, though, the same rough top 10 and the same rough bottom 10 when you throw out what I would call distance bias. Start with the presidents that are outside of living memory of the U.S. historians, or generally people, and some consistent rankings begin to appear. This is that get it out of living memory, then you can begin to assess them.
How do these polls handle someone like William Henry Harrison? He was in office for a very short time before he died.
Well, to keep that BCS analogy going, maybe he's the Boise State of presidents, because he certainly didn't have a very long schedule. All of 32 days, dying from a cold that he purportedly contracted on his inauguration day. Garfield is a similar president. He served all of 200 days, and his assassination coming right in the middle. Now, his assassination is going to lead to considerable civil service reform that we enjoy today, but he spent most of his presidency lying in agonizing pain if physicians probed his gunshot wounds, 80 of his 200 days in office. So he wasn't exactly directing the country. When he scored, it's in the high 20s, low 30s. This is a president that really served barely half a year when you factor in his decline. Now, I'll give credit here to Schlesinger, and in the media polls, Wall Street Journal, both of them don't include either president in their ranking, because how do you rank a president who was barely inaugurated before he departed the White House?
This is interesting to historians. It's interesting to people who like rankings, myself included, but do you think that any president really cares where they fall in one of these polls?
I'm sure for their legacy, many presidents yeah. do, but I think that John F. Kennedy may have had the best advice for what really, in many ways, are publicity stunts. He told one historian working on a biography of his life, this is the quote from JFK, "No one has the right to grade a president, even poor James Buchanan, who has not sat in his chair, examined the mail and the information that came across his desk, and learned why he made those decisions."
And until we sit across from this desk the next time,
we're history.
Bill Smith received both his master's and his Ph.D. in history at the University of Arkansas, and he's a history instructor at Northwest Arkansas Community College. This is Ozarks at Large. KUAF is conducting a music drive to collect jazz records for the KUAF Music Library. 12-inch vinyl jazz LPs in fair to good condition may be donated to the KUAF studios at 9 South School across from the Fayetteville Public Library. Then you can hear those albums played every Friday night at midnight on Goodnight Jazz with Daniel Estes. He's only playing vinyl jazz now. For more information, or if you'd like to schedule a local pickup, you can call us at 800-522-KUAF. And that just about wraps up a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large on KUAF. Support for Ozarks at Large comes from Pays Interactive, creating custom applications for web, PC, iPhone, and iPad. Information available at paysinteractive.com or at the iPhone App Store under PAZE. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Charleston, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen online at KUAF.com. This year's observance of Indigenous Peoples of the Americas Day will focus on the forced removal of Native Americans in the 1830s over the Trail of Tears. Part of the infamous trail that the Cherokee people took traverses northwest Arkansas. On Monday, the University of Arkansas will host a special program recognizing the Trail of Tears with the documentary The Trail of Tears, Cherokee Legacy, beginning at 10 a.m. in Giffel's Auditorium. The screening is free and is open to the public. More activities are scheduled to follow the documentary. For more information, 575-5961. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'll be back tomorrow at noon with another new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great Wednesday.